Welcome to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections Oral History Project, where we record the oral histories of current and former DOC employees. I'm DOC Communications Director Susan McNaughton. This oral history focuses on memories from the October 1989 riot at the State Correctional Institution at Camp Hill. Our guest today, September 6, 2019, is F. Andrew Smith, Jr., who was known while working at the prison as Fred Smith. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Before we begin, could you please provide us with a brief overview of your DOC career? Tell us at which facilities you worked and the titles that you held.
I started at the State Correctional Institution at Dallas in December of 71. I transferred to Camp Hill in August of 1974, and I retired from Camp Hill in July of 2002 as the reception lieutenant for the state of Pennsylvania.
Okay. All right, so let's get to the Camp Hill riot. Tell us what you remember about the riot, how it started, where you were, and what happened to you. So let's go to Wednesday, October 25th, 1989.
At approximately 2:30, they were bringing group 2 and 3 yard in off to the field. That night, I was the control desk sergeant. And got the first call that there was a situation happening at E-Gate. If memory serves me correctly, I think Officer Thomas was the E-Gate officer, and several inmates assaulted him. And then excuse the language, but all hell broke loose from there. We started receiving calls. They were trying to get the inmates into the housing units. Wasn't long after that, I was getting calls from E, F, G, H, J, and K blocks stating that they were being assaulted. They were trying to break into where the officers were. And after that, it was just call after call after call, asking for help.
Is that how they mostly were able to communicate back then, was through phones?
It was strictly through telephone, yes.
No radios?
We didn't have radios back in.
Wow. So that must have been pretty
hectic. We had megaphones at that time for the officers to communicate to the inmates on the block.
Right.
They had nothing. I mean, the officers basically were there. They had a set of keys for the lock boxes and stuff. In the doors, they had their voice and nothing else. And at that time, we had a sergeant, or no, I'm not even sure if they had a sergeant on the block back then. It was two officers per block.
Wow.
I think it was after they got the blocks resecured that they put sergeants on all the housing units. But I might be wrong. There may have been. Now, Mohawk, which was D block, they had a sergeant in there and two officers.
Mohawk was on the group one side, right?
That was on the group one side.
Okay. All right, so you're in the control center, you said?
I was in the control center.
Getting all of these calls. And what did you do?
I was making stenographic notes. Trying to keep the officers calm, relayed the information to the shift commander, and I don't know where the junior shift commander got to when hell broke loose. It was later that Deputy Hamner came in, Deputy Smith came in, and they were of no use. I mean, to be honest with you, they were of no use in the control center. I was the one that ordered the tower officers and the security patrol when they started assaulting them, officers outside the block, to shoot as necessary to protect the officers on the ground. Up to that point, there wasn't a shot fired. Later on, Deputy's assistant, Cindy Fitzingo, came in, and she manned the telephones while I manned the radio. The only ones that had radios was like the lieutenants, the area lieutenants and the area sergeants. So basically what I was getting over the radio was from them. The telephones was tower officers and the block officers. And this is all over Group 2 and 3. Group 1 was not affected the first night. If you didn't know better, like if you had just walked into the control center and sit there and seen what was going on, you would have thought that Cindy Fitzsingo was the deputy. She acted more like the deputy, and she made decisions that helped us out versus the deputies.
Tell me a little bit about what you heard about the hostages, like what was happening to them.
All that we were informed in the control center at that point was that the hostages were, some of them were being beaten. We didn't have any other picture of what was going on in the housing unit other than the fact that it was total chaos in there. They were trying to bust into the control boxes. Nathan Hargrove was in E block, and they busted some of the block out trying to get into him. I remember him distinctly because he called me I don't know how many times about getting help over there. And it's like they're trying to amass help. But I learned over the years that when you have a situation that drastic go down, you don't rush officers in, because they did. Marty Wilhelm, who's now deceased, let's see, who was the other one? Tom Mahady, he's now deceased. There was about 6-7 officers rushed over there to E-Gate, and they got assaulted. Mm-hmm. And Mahady and Wilhelm, those two in particular, that I remember because they were good, close friends, they wound up over in Harrisburg Hospital with major, what I consider major injuries. Wilhelm had his jaw bones, or this area, fractured. Mahady was hit over the head. Everyone who went over there got assaulted, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So
this went on for several hours.
Oh my God, that went on till. I want to say about 8-9 o'clock that evening, and this started about 2:30. And I remember going over to the major's office. Well, Superintendent Freeman, Deputy Smith, and Deputy Henry was there, along with Mike Kazar and the major, which was Major Stover. And they got all the inmates back in the housing units over there. That was the report I got from the lieutenant. And Major Stover says, okay, we need to send in teams to search these cell blocks and make sure that every, because the report was that the locking mechanisms weren't working. They were destroyed. And Mike Kazar stood up and said, excuse me, but we need to get the inmates checked for medical and get them fed first, which Superintendent Freeman agreed with Mike Kazar. So they threw security out the door right then and there. And later on, in my opinion, Major Stover took the fall for them breaking out day two, because the place was not secured whatsoever. And then after that, it was just, there wasn't much we could do that night other than we tried to count, well, we accounted for all the inmates. And then they were getting it, trying to get a count of the staff that were injured. So I guess it was 8 o'clock the next morning. Major Stover told me, go home, get some sleep. And I said, well, what time do you want me back? And he says, well, are you scheduled to work tomorrow? I said, no, I'll be on days off. And he goes, go home, get some sleep. We need you, we'll call you. Well, 5 o'clock came and they didn't call. So my wife and I, we went to Harrisburg Hospital to see the officers that were injured. And while we're over there, I can't think of his name. He come in and he goes, him and his wife come in and he goes, they're at it again over at Camp Hill. I said, that was last night. And he goes, well, one of the nurses said they're at it again. He goes, I'll go call him, which he calls the institution. He says, yeah, and it's worse than last night. So we said so long to Mahady and Wilhelm and the other ones, and we piled in two cars. I said, we can go in my vehicle. My wife knows. She can drop us off and she can go home. I'll call her when I want her. And we got back. I want to say we got the institution about 7:30 that evening. And, well, naturally, I'm in civilian clothes. They wouldn't let me in. They wouldn't let me inside the institution.
Oh.
So I'm out the main gate. Finally, somebody brought an overcoat out and gave it to me. Then they would let me in. So then I was in group one. We're securing the inmates on group one field. I was there all night. The next morning, I guess we were lined up over, we were over by E-Gate, and the state police went into group two and three, and then as they brought the hostages out, I helped escort them back over to the group one side where they had triage set up to check them out, whether they needed to be taken outside the institution or not. And I was doing this, doing that, all day long. And I guess it was, I was there till Saturday. I was supposed to go home at 4 o'clock because I've been on the clock for like, I don't know, 30 hours.
Yeah.
And they come to me and said, Sergeant Smith, you're taking Doc Bus up to Waymart. I said, I'm supposed to get off at 4 o'clock. Well, we don't have another Doc Bus Sergeant. You're going to Waymart. So went and they, I had two officers, two of the regular bus officers went with me. And we took the bus down to group two and three yard, pulled in there, and they gave us a list of inmates to load up. And we had, I guess there was two of them acted up. I told the state police, I ain't taking them. If they want to behave like that out here in the field with all the state police standing around with guns, I ain't taking them on a bus. They said, fine, put them back in the, they had like a big huddle, and they're putting back on the ground, said, you ain't going. So I put a check mark beside the names that I didn't take. And we ended up, we had three dock buses, two dock vans, and I think it was 14 school buses.
Wow.
We went out of there with 264 inmates.
All in like a convoy.
In a convoy. We had seven police cars in front of us, seven police cars in back of us, and each state police car had at least two troopers in. From the time we pulled out of Camp Hill, we never stopped until we pulled into Waymart.
Wow.
And the only problem we had going up, we were up around Hazleton, I guess, and graded for vans says, we just switched to our auxiliary tank. They forgot to fill up before we left. So now we're doing calculations of how many miles a gallon we're getting and what they get on a van. Our buses were fine. We all were topped off. And then they said, well, we can get fuel at Dallas. But they didn't want to break up the convoy. And then it was like, well, can we get a fuel truck to come out and fuel this? And I was on communications with the state police, and I said, you know what? I said, my calculations are correct. We can make it into Waymart. Okay. But we're going to need fuel at Waymart. So luckily, we made it into Waymart. They did have a fuel truck there for diesel fuel and gas to get gas everybody up, fuel everybody up. And we have one on the bus that I was driving that was acting up, and I told Superintendent White, I said, he don't belong up here. I said, do you have a maximum security area? He goes, not really. I said, I'll drop him off. All I need is the word. I'll drop him off down at Frackville. And then he sent word back down, no, we'll keep him here. I said, okay. And he said, get back to Camp Hill. And we got back to Camp Hill. That was Sunday morning at like 10 o'clock in the morning until we finally got back. But when we pulled in, when we pulled into Waymart, they had two fire trucks there with deluge guns on them. And do you know what a deluge gun is?
Big hose?
No, it's a, it looks like a pipe, but it's to shoot water, funnel it down under pressure.
Okay.
They had them set up that if there was any problem, they were gonna use the deluge guns on them. They had, I don't know how many fire trucks there. I think he had every local cop in the area up there. There was no, all, the only state police was the ones that escorted us in, and they stayed there till we got them processed off the bus, and they took them in, the officers there at, that they had from Waymart. I'm not sure where they were all from because they were not really ready to open Waymart at that time. But they took them in, processed them, we got our hardware, and then they released us, and we headed back to Camp Hill. So, and well, we had the school buses emptied first because they had no, all they had was the officers on board for security. So they got them off first. So they unloaded all 14, and as they unloaded them, they went down, got fueled, and they went back to Harrisburg because that's where they came out of.
Mm-hmm.
The dock vans and the dock, well, the dock vans were the next to be unloaded because they had the smaller number on board. And then the three dock buses, we had 28 on board except for me. I was too shy. So I come back, went home, reported back to work Monday morning, and deputy, or administrative assistant to the superintendent, Pilakovich, got a hold of me. And he goes, you were control desk sergeant when this started. I said, yep. He goes, we need to account for every inmate. Well, we spent all day Monday into Tuesday, and we accounted for every inmate but one.
Mm-hmm.
And we went over and over and over. And the rumor was that there was dead bodies over at Holy Spirit. And somebody just happened to mention, well, Jeff White took an inmate out of here on Friday night. And I said, I don't have anything on it. No inmate should have went out of that institution without paperwork indicating he was taken out of it. Well, apparently he was a snitch or something. I don't know. I don't remember the name. But got a hold of Jeff White. I said, did you take an inmate out of here on Friday night? He goes, I can't talk about it. I said, this is critical. I need to know who you took out, name and number, where you took him to. I don't care anything else about it. And he says, I can't talk about it. And Pilakovich heard him, and Pilakovich says, if you want to keep your job, you better start talking. Did you or did you not take an inmate out of here? And I forget what the other officer's name was with him, but he told Pilakovich who it was. I said, count's clear.
Wow.
That was our missing inmate.
Phew. What was Jeff White's capacity that he could take an inmate and not talk about it?
somebody from security snagged him and another officer, and the state police directed to take his inmate down to Cumberland County to be held for, you know, to get him out of prison because he apparently was giving up what was going on.
Okay.
So we called them snitches. But that, in other words, Jeff White and the other officer, and I can see his face, but I can't remember his name. They just got snagged, hey.
And they did what they were told.
But when they went out through the main gate, they should have gave the name and number. In other words, you don't take an inmate into the prison, you don't take an inmate out of the prison at that time unless you got a piece of paper.
So had somebody not told you, you probably would still be searching for this one inmate because
right.
he wasn't going to come forward and tell anybody.
Nope. And actually, we knew who we were missing because we went down through all the inmates in the institution. We had the list of every inmate by name and number that was taken out of the institution on Friday night because they took some to Smithfield. They took some up to the federal prison at...
Lewisburg.
No. Way up along above Route 6.
Oh.
There's a federal prison up there.
Right.
It's the coldest spot in Pennsylvania, believe it or not. If it's ever going to snow in Pennsylvania, it's the first place it snows. But there's a federal prison there.
Right, okay.
They took so many inmates up there. They took so many inmates out to Smithfield. I forget the exact number. But we had all the names and numbers of them. We had the name and number of every inmate we took up to Waymart. And we had name and number of every inmate. And it deduced down to... this one inmate. We knew who the inmate was, we just couldn't find him.
Wow.
And then when Jeff White finally gave it up, it's like, count's clear.
Wow. Well, thank you for that, because even some of the people that I'm interviewing still think that somebody was killed.
There was nobody, I can sit here right now and tell you, there was no inmates killed, there was no staff members killed. There was, I think, two inmates shot and taken over. One was, one went to osteopathic and the other one went to Holy Spirit, if I remember correctly.
Do you know what kind of wounds those were? Because
shotgun wounds.
Real shotgun wounds, not like bird shot or buck shot.
They charged the state police down by E-Gate and state police let off two rounds and two inmates dropped.
Okay.
The one, they couldn't believe that he, they actually couldn't believe that he lived. Because he took a pretty good shot to the stomach.
Wow.
And back then, I'm pretty sure the state police were using double white buck because they got the ammunition out of our armory to booster what they, I don't know what they used as their standard ammunition, but we used double white buck for our towers. And the state police needed extra shotgun shells, so we donated, I guess the best way
of
putting
it. Well, that was for a good cause, I suppose. So.
Yeah, it was for a good cause.
Yeah. So after the count cleared then, what did you do?
After count cleared, I went, well, Major Stover got a hold of me as I was coming out of Blockridge's office. And he goes, well, I don't know how we're going to man this place. We're down 100, I think it was 147 staff members that were injured. And he said, I don't know how I'm going to. I said, if I was in your shoes, the only way you're going to man this place is to go to two shifts. 6 at night to 6 in the morning and 6 in the morning to 6 at night. And I guess it was about 2 hours later, the word come down. Since I was on 2 to 10 shift, 2 to 10 shift and 10 to 6 was going 6 at night to 6 in the morning. 6 to 2 shift and the 8 to 4s and the extra people there, they were going 6 in the morning to 6 at night. I would have rather been on the 6 in the morning, 6 at night because I'm not a night person.
Right.
And I don't sleep too well when the sun's up. But after that, it's wherever they needed me. And I was that way for the rest of that day. And 2 days later, I went to work at 6 at night. And George Nichols was the 10 to 6 desk sergeant. And I was 2 to 10 desk sergeant. So what they decided to do, since we were the senior sergeants for the control center, when George was off, I was control desk sergeant. When I was off, he was control desk sergeant. So it ended up, when he was on the control desk, I was line sergeant for group one, and vice versa. So we flip-flopped that way. We did that for 7 months.
Wow.
And then I guess, well, it was May sometime when we went back on regular shift. And
May of 1990, wow.
Oh, yeah. And then I guess it was, I want to say December of 90 is, no, I had been, yeah, December of 90, I made lieutenant. And then I went to Mohawk.
What were you thinking?
Well, I'd worked Mohawk for, when I came to Camp Hill, since I had 2 years, 8 months experience at Dallas, you're going to Mohawk.
So just for historical purposes and for the listeners, what was Mohawk and how did it get its name?
Actually, all the housing units, when the place first opened, had Indian names. And the only one that stuck over the years was Mohawk.
Oh.
Mohawk was a restrictive housing unit. In other words, you did something you weren't supposed to do that was serious, you went to the hole, as they called it.
Right.
Only they, and there they referred to it as Mohawk. You're going to Mohawk. And you were locked up. In Mohawk, you were locked up for basically, you got out of your cell for an hour exercise a day and a shower. Other than that, you were locked in.
Right.
You were fed in your cell. A nurse from medical come down every day and passed out the meds in their cell. If they claimed of something drastic, then they were taken up to the dispensary and treated and seen by a doctor or whatever.
But under tight escort, I'm sure.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
They were cuffed, and you when they came out of their cell, they were cuffed.
Yeah.
They just didn't walk out and walk up. Now they get a waist chain and a leash on them. They're handcuffed to a waist chain. And then they have a leash like on them.
Yeah.
And if they're really, really bad, they get leg irons put on them. And they have a minimum of 2 officers, an escort.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Talk to me about the control center the second night. So you weren't in it, but people were stuck in there.
They burn out the deputy's office.
Which deputy was that, Smith?
Deputy Smith.
Uh-huh.
And they were trying to burn out the control center.
Mm-hmm.
From what I was told, those people got out of the control center and they went up to the second floor, and then they ended up, Jim Oxer apparently ramrodded it, and they got out through a window onto the Carter rooftop, and I don't know how they got down off of that, but that's how they got out from upstairs. But they were trying to burn them out.
Wow.
So
when you finally went back to being the control desk sergeant, I mean, it was all burned out then? I mean,
No. They didn't actually burn the control center.
Okay.
They burnt the deputy's area, which was right behind the control center.
Okay. Oh.
So, they did quite a bit of damage. Luckily, the two control gates. The bottom line at Camp Hill, when the decision was made to start transferring these inmates out on Friday evening, the big question was where to put them. And the main reason they were doing it was to lower the population down because of all the damage to the cells. When they finally got them locked up, I mean, they went out and bought big bull chains and padlocks. And I mean, the officers.
Okay, so they went out and got padlocks.
I think they went to Fager's, but don't quote me on that. Purchasing was calling around where they could get, well, had it been, excuse me, you had,
about 800.
800, well, we'll say 900 padlocks and 900, and it's a chain that they could cut into a certain length and get them over the institution as quickly as possible. We actually didn't have the equipment for a ride like that, just to re-secure. I mean, they were taking the officers were taking their handcuffs and handcuffing doors closed.
Oh my.
And you get to go on, I mean, handcuffs, you don't have everything tight. So therefore you got a little bit of movement. Well, they get on there and start yanking. Well, they busted quite a few handcuffs.
Mm.
And it wasn't until we got these bull chains in that you really could secure the cells. But the ones that were had the walls busted out and so forth, you couldn't use them. And that was the reason they were looking where they could send all these inmates. And that's why they sent up in the cold region and also out to Smithfield. And then the commissioner made the decision, we're gonna open up Waymart right away, even though they weren't ready. They didn't even have that many staff up there at the time, so they pulled staff out of Frackville and Dallas, and I think Retreat also. They pulled so many staff out of there, because Rockview, Huntington, I think we even got them from Greensburg. They came into Camp Hill. Hell, the state police, they're lucky they didn't have any major problems in the state, because 3/4 of state troopers were at Camp Hill.
Right.
But that was the reason. We couldn't secure the facility totally. They needed to lower the population. And then, I'm not sure what the time frame after that was, where we started taking them to Lewisburg. And I'll never forget this one. He was raising Holy Cane. I says, keep it up. I said, you wind up in Alaska. And he thought I was kidding.
Yeah.
And I was.
Yeah.
I actually was kidding. Well, when they started coming back from, because Lewisburg took them in, processed them, and then they shipped them all over the United States. Well, this one, I picked him up over at Harrisburg Airport and brought him back to Camp Hill, along with others. But he goes, boy, you weren't kidding about Alaska, were you? And I don't know how he wound up there. I didn't have nothing to do with it. And then there was another one. He wound up in Fort Polk, Louisiana. And down there, they're racial. And he was a black individual, and he mouthed off to the wrong person, I guess, in the federal. And he ended up in Fort Polk, and he goes, I don't see how anybody in the Army ever wanted to be at that place. So that wasn't too nice of a place either. And the third place I heard that wasn't nice was upstate Minnesota somewhere. Especially in the wintertime, and they were up there in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. So, but I don't know how many trips I got sent on over to the airport to pick inmates up and to bring them back to Camp Hill.
Wow. What are some other major memories that you recall that come to mind?
Well, I think one of the biggest mistakes was the tower officers had seen officers being assaulted, beaten on the ground. One of them in particular, they were stabbing him. And they didn't even fire a warning shot. I mean, when those Larry Arnold or Mike Arnold fired the first warning shot, and the minute that shotgun went off, they scattered. Now, they probably saved, it was Larry Arnold, I guess. That saved his life. And I think had the other tower officers that had the opportunity to do that, it was in close conjunction, especially the security patrol officer was sitting right there by the tower. Never fired a shot. Never did nothing. Those, I think, were factors that could have helped save quite a few. The way it went down, the way the facility was laid out, communications, all those factors we learned after the fact. If we had that way back when, I think it would have been a different story. And the other thing was, parole violators, there's no reason for them to be sitting around in one facility like that. They should have been dispersed throughout the state and wait for the parole board to decide what they were going to do with them, not congregate them all in one. Basically, they were congregating in one housing unit.
Wow.
And there's where it started at, E Block. I mean, I don't have sympathy for them. If you got paroled and you can't go out there and behave yourself, and you can get picked up for a parole violation and brought back, I'm sorry, you finish the rest of your sentence, and then if you have new charges pending, you serve that too. There's, you had your chance, but they wanted to be, oh, I shouldn't have been brought back. It's, I didn't have any sympathy.
Yeah.
But I did, and that was a big factor that started all this. A bunch of hotheads in there, and all those parole violators, they just jumped on the bandwagon. So.
And some of the other issues people talked about was the sick line call policy was changed, and family day was canceled.
The family day was canceled. I didn't totally agree with the family day policy in one respect. It's okay in another respect, but bringing food in from the outside, there was too much contraband coming in the food, and there's no way. I mean, if you went in there and started digging around in that food, the outside people were complaining, and then we were told don't do it. And
oh, so just let the food in. Don't
yeah.
Don't dig
pretty
the
much
potato salad.
Right, and that kind of stuff was even the officers that did the guest house and everything, they were upset about that. I know the sick line policy, and I don't think it was that drastic, but those little things there, it's just like the pro violator's throwing a can of gasoline on a fire. You already got the fire. Now, these are just issues that they want to build on. When they met with the superintendent and deputies on day two.
Mm-hmm.
It was all basically the issues that they were complaining about were BS issues. They were not major issues. The major issue that they did talk about was they're sitting there doing nothing and they're not getting processed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really not the institution fault, that's the parole board's fault. The parole board has to make a decision if they're going to revoke the parole permanently, extend their sentence, etc. The institution doesn't do that. So all the institution does is send a report to the parole board saying, hey, we got this guy back, and this is the paper, this is the paperwork that come with him. And then basically we're holding him for the parole board.
Yeah, and for days, months?
Oh my God. Some of them were in there a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
Just to find out that they might be just re-paroled.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a slow process. Personally, and this goes all the way back when I first came to Camp Hill, I don't think there should be a parole system. I think that there should be flat sentencing. You do the crime, you got the time. Now, if you do the time, I guess you'd call it good behavior. In other words, your sentence can be reduced based on good behavior. But
once you're done, you're done.
Once you're done, you're done. I think there's a few other sentences that don't belong in state prison. Don't even belong in county prison, really. There was a concept thrown out years ago to, for example, DUIs. Instead of putting them in state prison, send them to South Mountain Restoration Center and let them empty bedpans and help take care of the patients down there at no cost to the taxpayer. You don't do it, then you can be sent to prison. Different alternatives like that. It would take some of the stress off the Department of Corrections. So,
anything else?
Nothing to think of.
Okay, I'm going to push stop.